fighting for justice, fighting against vicious legacy that not just white supremacy, but of male supremacy, losing sight of humanity of anybody in a society that tends so often to overlook the least of these. So I salute 90 years of struggle, and I'm glad to be one small voice in that caravan.
Yes, sir. So Dr. West, Brother West, I want to start with this question, and it's the idea of America, the possibility of America. One of the things that we are hearing more and more is this idea that things are more divisive than most people can remember. Some will say it's the most divisive ever. I would argue that we've simply pulled the covers and shown what's under the bed. It's always been there. These are issues we're reckoning with. But as we think about America and the possibility of America and this idea of working to create and inhabit that nation that we dream of, can you talk to us about what you see the steps being? I mean, I wouldn't dare to ask you for a roadmap, but perhaps you can offer us a compass of where we should be going as we dream of this America and the possibility of America.
Thank you for the question. I think I would begin with wonderful line in the great W.B. Du Bois's second autobiography, Dust at Dawn, when he says America suffers from a fear of being truthful about itself, and that therefore it's willing to use lies as a method of human uplift. And you can only go so far based on mendacity. And usually mendacity has an intimate relation with criminality. See, the lies viewed as the normal order of things is a way of hiding the crimes that are viewed as the natural order of things. So America's always had a deep tendency to normalize mendacity and naturalize criminality. So if you really talk about the idea of America, you can't talk about that unless you talk about indigenous peoples, their land, their babies, their people, disappear. Well, they don't disappear. See, they're killed, they're violated, they're subjugated, they're dominated, they hate it, they despise, they dishonor. That's why a lot of times you hear on television, slavery was America's original sin. That's a lie. It was indigenous peoples first. White supremacy moves fast. But the second one was the enslavement of Africans. You got to tell the truth. And the question then becomes, well, you can only go so far based on lies and crimes because chickens come home to roost. You're going to reap what you sow. Sooner or later, what you repress is going to return. And we saw that in the Civil War. We saw it in the 1960s, and we're seeing it again. We're seeing it now in a very vicious right-wing neo-fascist form, but not just Donald Trump, but with the people behind Trump. The neo-Nazis and the Klan and others feeling very much emboldened and in power with the atavistic, chauvinistic elites that Trump and the others represent right now in the history of the American empire and the history of the American democratic experiment. So fundamentally, we just have to be truthful. Now, what has been crucial about the black freedom struggle is the black freedom struggle has been the major leaven in the American democratic loaf. What I mean by that is that the Frederick Douglasses, Ida B. Wells Barnetts, J. Philip Randolphs, Martin King, Ella Baker, Fannie Lou Hamer, the movements that they represent, they have been the leaven that has allowed the American democratic loaf to both remain fresh and expand. When the black freedom movement is weak, the loaf gets stale. When the truth-telling gets weak, the lies become more predominant. Now, mendacity and criminality are opposed primarily by two things. By love. You wouldn't have the Jackson County Law or Bar Association unless you had lawyers who still love black people enough to tell the truth about white supremacy. If you get lawyers obsessed with success rather than greatness, and love is great and success is money, then lo and behold, you're not going to have strong enough voices bringing power and pressure to bear. So when you say Charles Houston Hamilton, you're not just talking about a brilliant lawyer. You're talking about somebody who's willing to live and die for black people, live and die for justice. Thurgood Marshall the same way. to go into the jaws of Jim Crow as lawyers. That's a serious thing, because usually when you get a lawyer, professional, managerial class, you're not talking about life or death no more. You're talking about which suburb you're going to choose from to live in. See, so these are serious folks. Charles Howard Sr., one of the founders of the National Bar Association up in Iowa. We were talking about the relationship between that national organization, Black Lawyers, and Jackson County, who was a lawyer for Paul Robeson, who was a lawyer for W.B. Du Bois. He was disbarred and became the leading journalist of his day as a lawyer. That's the kind of spirit we're talking about if we're going to be able to deal with the forms of mendacity, the forms of criminality that are now presently confronting us. And I say this especially for young people, because young people have been taught in the last 40 years that life is fundamentally about success and being the smartest person in the room. And that's spiritually hollow and empty.
Especially with how we're defining success, right?
That's it. And defining smartness.
Right, right.
Definitely. Du Bois has a wonderful line, and so does the black folk, when he says black people historically have been one of the few, the kind of oasis in a dusty desert of smartness and dollars. What happens when they're seduced by smartness and dollars in such a way that they lose sight of what is truthful, righteous, sacrificial, service to the least of these? That's a spiritual and moral issue. It's just not political.
We're going to pause right here for a break. We'll be right back with Cornel West, Dr. Cornel West.
Support for KKFI comes from Midwest Music Foundation, presenting the inaugural Gotoberfest Golf Tournament on October the 8th at Adams Point Golf Club in Blue Springs, Missouri, a fundraiser for Gumpy's Foundation, providing families with resources for the holidays, and the Midwest Music Foundation, serving the area's music community with health care assistance, education, career development, and emergency resources. Gotoberfest Golf Tournament on October the 8th at Adams Point Golf Club. All information is at gotoberfest.com. That's gotoberfest.com.
This is Sharon Lockhart. We are bringing you Dr. Cornel West live from the UMKC Law School, and this is sponsored by the Jackson County Bar Association, and this is the kind of programming KKFI is able to bring you because we are non-commercial, non-corporate, but we need your support and your dollars. So call 888-931-0901. That's 888-931-0901 to make your pledge to keep this kind of programming independent and radical thought, free thought, on the air at KKFI.
In a beacon of liberty, and yet still talk the world so much about how to love. That's where John Coltrane's Love Supreme comes from. It's true. That's what Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, every note shot through with love. James Baldwin's essays, every sentence, all those commas shot through with love. There's never been a character on the stage of America that had more love than Lorraine Hansberry's mama in A Raisin in the Sun. That genius from the south side of Chicago, she wrote that almost as a teenager. But she comes out of a tradition, a family, a church and mosque and synagogue. We got black Jews, we got black Muslims, we got black Christians and agnostics like James Baldwin. But it was a people who mustered enough courage to love themselves, to respect themselves, to tell the truth about themselves, America, and the world, and then dished it out to the world. Now, we here in Kansas City, I could just say bird and shut up. I could just see Charlie Parker and shut up. 34 years old, he's gone. They said his body was like that of a 65-year-old because he gave himself unbelievably, mastered his craft, practiced for 15 hours for 4 years, and still was a drug addict. But he talked the world so much about love, excellence, service to others, so that a Coltrane could listen to him as a teenager and say, I want to be like that.
Yeah.
I want to be like him. I want that excellence. I want that love. I want that service, sense of service. I want that sense of justice. Yeah. And I want to be cool and hip, too. Yeah. And it wasn't just Train. It was Mary Lou Williams. We can go on and on. I got to settle down with all these. I'll make sure the answer's not too long. Because
So let's talk about something here. You talked about the mendacity and the criminality, and you talked about the lies. You talked about our unwillingness to speak truth. And then you talked about our current administration and white supremacy and all those things, not just white supremacy, you talked about male supremacy.
That's right.
That's fueling this movement. And yet at the same time, we have these scholars who are trying to tell us that November 8, 2016, was not about race. It was about the middle class, not the middle class, the working class. And what they really mean is the white working class, because they're not referring to working class of color.
That's right.
But that the working class have been abandoned by the liberals. So how do we then take this conversation? Because it seems to me the possibility of America is impossible on our own, right?
True.
We have to go beyond to the majority and get them on board. So what is the conversation? What is the narrative that we take to those, presumably, who white supremacy was not the driving force?
Mm-hmm.
Let's just take that hypothetically.
Yes, yes, and that's a crucial question because it sits at the center of so much of the dialogue these days.
Mm-hmm.
And my dear brother Coates, Ta-Nehisi Coates, he's a brilliant journalist and a very good writer in many ways. He's been presenting this view as if it's fundamentally about race, almost all about race. And there's no doubt that white supremacy is very much at the center of it, but you can never understand white supremacy unless you understand empire. That's why I started with indigenous peoples. You see, there have been six wars going on simultaneously for the last 8 years under Obama. Dropped 26,155 bombs in 2016. Drone strikes, Somalia, Pakistan, Afghanistan. For every dollar in the U.S. budget, 53 cents goes to the military-industrial complex for imperial projects. So you're only dealing with 47 cents even when you get to the domestic dialogue, you see. So that the white supremacy that we talk about cannot be just confined to the domestic dynamics. Du Bois taught us. C.L.R. James taught us. James Baldwin taught us. We are a nation among nations in the world. And when you have 4,855 military bases around the world in 42 countries with 150 countries having U.S. special operations. That's an empire. And we're experiencing the decline and the decay of the empire. Because you got military overreach. Then you've got massive corruption of your elites with Wall Street and big business and big corporations. We know how many Wall Street executives went to jail after massive crimes committed in 2008, insider trading, market manipulation, predatory lending, fraudulent activity. Not one went to jail. But let Jamal and Letitia get caught with a crack bag. Straight to jail. So that you can never talk about just race in and of white supremacy in and of itself. You got to talk about empire, then you got to talk about class. And you especially got to talk about gender. 52% of the mankind are women. So it's not like you're doing them a favor by including them in your analysis. They're not a minority. Patriarchy is real. It kills people. You see, in black communities, brown communities, white communities, and so forth. So this idea of race as an abstraction that's not intimately connected to empire, predatory capitalism, grotesque wealth inequality, 1% population, only 42% of the wealth. That's a class question. And then we got homophobia and transphobia. Mm-hmm. And when you're talking about black people, you're talking about James Baldwin. He's a gay brother. You're talking about Audre Lorde. She's a lesbian sister. You're talking about trans folk, you see. And it's not PC chit-chat. You're trying to be truthful. The condition of truth is to allow suffering to speak. That's everybody's suffering. That's not just one slice of humanity's suffering. That's everybody. You got to be international. And some people say we ought to include the dogs and the donkeys and things in terms of animals' rights. Well, that's a different dialogue. I can be open to that. That's fine. That's fine. But I want Letitia and Jamal included.
Right.
And I want to start on the chocolate side of town. And the reason why I start, I have a bias. My mama's black. And my grandfather's black. But that doesn't mean I love others less. But usually when people talk in universal terms, they don't include black people. They don't include brown. They don't include red, you see. So you've got to be explicit in terms of starting on the chocolate side of things and then allowing the love and the justice to spill over to vanilla and other sides, you see. So So in that sense, when we're really talking about the election, mm-hmm. we're really talking about the ways in which the American empire was in deep crisis. And the response was you had two political parties. You had a right-wing party that was undergoing deep crisis, and the billionaire leapfrog over the establishment in the Republican Party, surprised them and everybody else. Then you had a Democratic Party, also in deep crisis, thinking that all they had to do was to trot out the same kind of neoliberal white candidate, and somehow she was going to beat this manipulative, entertaining gangster. And that's what Donald Trump is. He's a gangster. I said, oh, Brother West, that's hard. No, that's not hard at all. A gangster is not a subjective expression, it's an objective condition. When you're grabbing women's private parts without their permission, that's gangster. When you're stealing somebody else's oil without their permission, that's gangster. That's an objective condition. Trump has been doing that for over 45 years. How did a right-wing gangster tied to white supremacy, tied to expansion of empire, misogynist to the core, homophobic, win the election? That's the question.
That is the question.
And it's a combination of deeply white supremacist sensibilities being mobilized, of grotesque wealth inequality, with people feeling completely helpless, completely impotent, completely unable to exert any kind of power. And that was working class, which is multiracial, mm-hmm. across the board. Mm-hmm. And it was also misogynist. The gender question was very important. Very important. And 53% of white sisters voted for the gangster. You know, that's not a salutary fact.
But we have the
94%
though.
The 94% of black folk who voted against Trump. You're absolutely right. But then, you know, they voted for Hillary. You say, well, the anti-Trump, I can understand. It's hard to get excited about a neoliberal, pro-Wall Street, pro-imperial figure like Hillary Clinton, who called my young brother super predators in the 90s. Mm-hmm. Now, if that's the choice we got to make between the gangster and the liar, hey, you know, somebody pass the cognac, you know what I mean? I'll take Hennessy, you take Cavassier. very much so. I mean, the sad thing was in the election that for the first time in decades, the most progressive bloc in the Democratic Party refused to go for the most progressive candidate, Bernie Sanders.
What do you think that was about?
Bernie Sanders was not known among black folk. Black folk like to know somebody before they vote for him. He was not that well known.
What could he have done to rectify that?
I think that he could have started earlier in talking about his long history of fighting against white supremacy. But Hillary Clinton also was part of a neoliberal clientage network, because they got a lot of money among the black leaders and black preachers and so forth. So they hardly even gave Bernie Sanders a chance to be heard, because they already had lined up behind Hillary Clinton. And that to me is that's a deep crisis of black leadership. I know that's another lecture, that's another dialogue. But when it comes to our black leaders, we've got too many of them who just up for sale.
Yeah.
They just up for sale, that's all. We got too many of them.
So let me ask
you. Not all of them, but too many of them really are.
So this question then, you know, that makes me think about 2004.
Yes.
Yeah, before Barack Obama won the Iowa primaries. A lot of our black elite, black leadership, was against him and was...
Oh, 2008.
Him.
2008.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, 2008. No, you're absolutely right. Yeah, I remember sitting in the room with Brother Barack Obama. Who else was in there? It was Eric Holder was in there. Jesse Jackson Jr. was in there. At that time, we had 4% of black America supporting Barack Obama, because they didn't think he could win. Now, I told Brother Barack, I see, look, I've been known to make some real bad predictions, but you're going to win this thing, because all we had to do was to leapfrog over the Clinton machine and win. He just was not that well known. And black folk didn't really shift until after Iowa. Mm-hmm. We went down to South Carolina and spent 2.5 weeks every day in South Carolina, and that was a real push, as it were. Mm-hmm. But my argument was, in many ways, the same as it is today, that I thought that the Clinton's neoliberal machine had to be overcome. And by neoliberal, I mean those who see a social problem and their instinct is to privatize, financialize, or militarize. So you get gentrification, privatize healthcare, privatize education, privatize across the board, put a little weight to public things, public health, public schools, so forth and so on. And then bring in big banks, bring in, financialize. And so we had long talks about Brother Barack and so forth, and we had serious discussions about Wall Street and big corporate power and big business and big money and so forth and so on. And once the turning took place and it looked as if, oh, black folk were going to come home, black folk get a sense of who is this Barack Obama? Oh, I see, we might have a chance. I also saw my brother leaning more and more toward Wall Street, toward the corporate elites, and that's why I had to to be consistent and start going at him.
So let's talk about that, Brother West. Let's talk about
too many children poor to be Wall Street friendly. I mean, when Barack had the meeting in March 2009 with the head Wall Street elites, it's a very important meeting. It's in the book called Confidence Man, Ron Suskind. And he told him explicitly, I stand between you and the pitchforks, but I want to let you know I'm on your side. I will protect you. I said, you don't say that to Wall Street elites. You say that to the kids. You say that to people. You say that to working people. You say that to people catching hell. Wall Street doesn't need to hear that. If you say you stand between them and the pitchforks, let them shudder. Let them shake and say, I'm going to pursue justice. And some of y'all going to jail. Because that's exactly what the judges do to the young brothers and sisters when they up on crimes. That's what they do. We're going to look at the evidence, and you might go to jail.
You're tuned to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. This is Urban Connections. I'm your host, Donna Morrow Wolf. Our co-hosts, Barry Jackson and Ebony Johnson, are on site at this live broadcast from UMKC's Law School of Dr. Cornel West. I don't want to deprive you of this, so I'm going to pot it back up and we'll check in with you in a little while. 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio, bringing you live broadcast of Dr. Cornel West speaking today at UMKC. It is our pledge drive. We need your support to continue bringing you this type of programming. Give us a call now at 888-931-0901, 888-931-0901. We return you to Dr. Cornel West.
What Black America has struggled with, and many people have been upset with you, including me.
Oh, I understand.
In all honesty.
No, and I know it's in love, and I appreciate that. We got to correct each other in love now.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Is that it felt as if there was 8 years of blistering critique of the first Black president, who, as you admitted, was elected into a system that's an empire.
Absolutely.
We have a system of world hegemony.
That's right.
We have a world order that we have spent a long time creating. And the president has to deal with issues that are interrelated and interlaced. And we're dealing with, or we were at the time, an economic
collapse. That's right.
Trying to prevent it from being a depression. And so here he is trying to do what he can. Now, not to say that because he's Black and the first one, that he should have gotten a pass. But in retrospect, looking at what he was dealing with, looking at the white supremacy, and I believe that race was a factor in Hillary Clinton losing as well. The idea that we already had 8 years of this Black guy, we're not sure we want this white woman to follow him.
I think that was another element. I'd agree
with that. But given everything that you've already talked about, the narrative that is out there, the complex issues that have to be tackled, looking back in your critique of President Obama, you know, at one point you even said that he was niggerized.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You said he's a person who is afraid and intimidated when it comes to putting a spotlight on white supremacy.
Absolutely. But he was reluctant for 7 years to hit race head on.
He was.
And I have personal experience of that in terms of my works with the prison and the juvenile delinquency. If we raise this issue, Brother West, they're going to think that somehow we are too identified with black people. What's wrong with being identified with black people if we're right? Now, we got black gangsters and thugs. We don't need to be identified with gangsterism. But if we're just and right, what's wrong with being identified? Fox News gonna cuss you out anyway.
True.
I don't want to hear strategies and tactics. I want to know what principles you have. What are you standing for? Do you know what has gone into the election of a black president after 400 years of black people struggling in this nation? And to get a chance to bail out homeowners rather than Wall Street, that's consistent with Martin Luther King Jr. That's consistent with Frederick Douglass. That's consistent with Ida B. Wells. He bailed out Wall Street. How many homeowners were bailed out? 58% of black people lost their homes. Our black middle class was shattered. A lot of them still trying to dog pedal in the water. That's a matter of taking a stand. He could have taken a stand. Now, he could have taken a stand and lost. We got a long history of that in black America. Malcolm took a stand, lost in terms of getting killed, but his spirit is alive. Martin took a stand, won and lost. His spirit's alive. Yes. Dorothy Irene Hite took a stand. She lost and won. Her spirit's alive. We used to lose them, but you got to try. You got to make an effort. You got to take a stand. You stand for Wall Street over homeowners. That's not in the legacy of the best of what black people have given the world. You see what I mean?
Yes.
That's what I mean. So the question then becomes, well, how do you say it, Brother West? Well, you say it in such a way that this is what Brother Sharpton used to go on. Man, I love Brother Sharpton to death. He was just wrong, too. And I just talked to him. He loved me today. He's wrong. We come out of the same tradition. We black church tradition. You know, we just gave a eulogy to Dwight McKee's mama. We sitting right next to each other. We crying together because we come out of the same tradition. Mm-hmm. We can disagree in the same tradition, but we got to be honest with ourselves. Mm-hmm. We have to be honest with who we are. You see? And Sharpton used to tell me all the time, Brother West, you know, your criticism helping the right wing is better not to say anything at all. And I said, your silence is helping corporate America that's doing in some working and poor people. Now, somehow we got to learn from each other. You see? And so the ways in which, if I'm criticizing the relation of Wall Street, if I'm criticizing, you can assassinate a U.S. citizen with no due process. That's fascist. That's wrong. You see, that's what happened. How many U.S. citizens were assassinated under the Obama administration? 15-year-old boy and his daddy. Well, you disagree with them. They're members of a terrorist group. I understand. I don't believe that a Ku Klux Klan person ought to be killed and murdered and assassinated without due process. And I'm not pro-Klan. You can see that. They got the cross, I got the cross. We got a different conception of the cross. But there's such a thing as rights and liberties to be protected. Because we got Fred Hampton, we got Bobby Hutton, who was shot down by the police, killed by the FBI, with no due process at all. That's barbaric. Same was true when these citizens were killed, who happened to be tied to Middle East organizations. So in that sense, that's where I thought it was very important that the best of our tradition be enacted, because it's really not about Barack or me or anybody else. It's about what has been put in us in terms of the tradition of struggle all those centuries. And we just a moment in that tradition. Mm. We just a moment in that tradition.
So let's talk about passing it forward then.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, one of the things about Dr. Martin Luther King.
Oh, Brother Martin.
Yeah, is that his work wasn't just, you know, simply about civil rights. It was deeply rooted in religion and spirituality.
Absolutely.
Those two things were a component of it. I listened to Dr. Vincent Harding, an interview where he talked about how, you know, the song, This Little Light of Mine, you know, and just some of the traditions coming out of the black church and that movement, it was about hope. It was about this hope for America. And there are people now who don't believe that there is as much hope, whether it's people who criticize the Black Lives Matter movement and say that they have no goal, they're not focused on hope, what's the objective, or even people like, you know, our brother Ta-Nehisi Coates, who recently was interviewed and said that he really didn't have hope. Now, of course, there's a context between what he said. But let's talk about passing it on to the next generation. this idea of hope, idea of still being rooted in spirituality and being able to see human dignity and worth in everyone.
Absolutely.
And being able to take this work in a way that we break down barriers. Because in as much as you've pointed out that Barack Obama, for example, didn't talk about race until the eighth year, there's a large portion of America that considers him extremely divisive and racist because of the few things that he actually did do on race. And so there is this deep need we have as a culture to go beyond being in the echo chamber, speaking to the choir, and connecting across the lines. So how do we pass on? How do we take from our elders what you guys have done and continue to do and pass it on? Mm. You know, we have a young person here who say, what are some of the most important things that activists can do to weaken and deconstruct mass incarceration? We have somebody else ask, you know, how can I be part of, you know, what strategies should activists employ to weaken and dismantle the new Jim Crow? That's Jason Hill. Yeah. And that's a question that we have, right? How do we hold on to the hope? How do we take the next step? How do we keep this going? How do we connect with those people that are completely disconnected with the suffering and the experiences of the poor, of the LGBT, of the people of color, of the immigrant, of the Muslim? How do we go about doing that? Mm. In ways that translate, right?
That's
not
right.
In ways that sounds like, you know, we're having a conversation with ourselves.
That's right. That's right. Well, I think there's two fundamental pillars. One is you have to really care. Mm-hmm. There's no way you're going to have a mass incarceration regime unless you have a whole host of people who don't really care that much about the people who are being incarcerated. And this is a class question in Black America. If you had Jack and Jill brothers and sisters, upper middle class brothers and sisters going to jail at the same level as you had in the hood, we'd have different kind of black leadership. That's a fact. Well, I happen to love all of them. So I'm just as upset when it's coming out of the hood as I am when it's coming out of Black Jack and Jill local branches. That's what I learned at Shiloh Baptist Church in Sacramento, California. I'm going to be true to that. So I got a critique of the black middle class. Mm-hmm. They didn't care enough. Going to these schools, you ain't going to send your kids to those schools. How come you allowed it? How come we don't have protests of them going to these schools? Those are our kids too. Mm-hmm. It's indifference. Get a distance. Get detached. So we don't care enough. Then if you care, you got to have courage. You got to have courage. Courage means what? You got to cut against the grain. Mm-hmm. You're not in it for popularity. I have never tried to say something or do something just to be popular among black people. Ever. I love black people because they're worthy of being black. And a lot of them confused. Because everybody's been confused. And I love others too. I'm not saying I just only love black folk, but I told you I'll start with those used to be called Negroes. So what that means is we got a care deficit. Mm-hmm. That means we need a spiritual revolution. Yeah. Then you got a courage deficit. You got a moral revolution. You see? And so when I talk about we got a black middle class that's been niggerized in the sense that they got money, position, and title, but they still too scared because they're worried about their careers rather than the truth. That's what I was talking about Barack. I love Barack. He's brilliant. He's poised. He gets in his major position for 7 years, can hardly say a mumbling word about race and mumbling word about the new Jim Crow. He's scared, but he's brilliant, he's upper middle class, but he's niggerized. To be niggerized is to be so fearful, intimidated, and scared that you won't speak the truth. It's not a matter of material level only. That's what white supremacy does. If you can niggerize black people to keep them so scared they don't want to speak the truth, they don't want to be caring for each other, then you don't have to worry about a revolt. You don't have to worry about resistance. You don't have to worry about the Jackson County Bar Association having lawyers who's going to be concerned about what's happening in Ferguson and Baltimore and Charlottesville and so forth. You're going to have black lawyers who like to socialize in nice places and pat each other on the back. You're going to have peacocks. Peacocks strut because they can't fly. You have peacocks rather than eagles. We come from a tradition of eagles. The eagle stirs his nest. The ego has nobility. The ego has determination and keeps track on the ground of those catching hell. Now, you juxtapose the eagle and a peacock. That's what we've been dealing with. See? So when Martin Luther King Jr. sits in the Oval Office of Brother Barack, I'm saying he's shedding tears. He's from the eagle group. He's looking for you to fight for the poor. He's looking for you to fight for working people. He's looking for you to fight for homeowners. He's looking for you to fight for those who are victimized by the drone strikes, not dropping the drone strikes. Or when Brother Coates, in his latest book, and I love the discussion that he's generating, you turn to page 103 in that book, and he talks about the legacy of Malcolm X. And he says, when Ozzie Davis said at Malcolm X's funeral, he is our shining black prince. And then Coates says, and for us, that's what Barack Obama is, just like Malcolm X, a shining black prince. I say, brother, you got your history wrong. Barack Obama is brilliant, poised, but he ain't no Malcolm X, brother. Let's be honest about it. You got to quit lying. Now, some of the white folk may want to break dance on that because they don't know what's going on in terms of the tradition that produced a Malcolm X and a Barack Obama. You start assimilating that, and the next thing you know, people are going to think that Kenny G is John Coltrane. And once you reach that point, we all go to the crack house because, I mean, it's over. It's over. You know what I mean? It's over. Pat Boone is Curtis Mayfield. You really believe that? It's over. It's over. Everybody take crack and go on. You can't mislead folk like that. You can't lie like that. Too much went into making a Malcolm.
So I'm going to ask you, though, to at least give Colt some credit.
Oh, yes.
Yes. And for the things that Barack Obama has done well or did do well that would exemplify the good parts of what you're talking about. There has to be something.
Oh, no. Like I said, he's brilliant. He was poised. That he provided.
Not that.
What else?
The good stuff.
That is good, being brilliant and poised.
No, I mean, the stuff that you're talking about that's more rooted. Yeah. Rooted in the spirituality.
Well, I mean, I think health care was a positive thing. He just didn't fight for what he said he was going to fight for, which is not just single payer, but you can't leave 20 million people out and say you got universal health care. That's a lie. You just expanded it for big pharmaceutical companies and big insurance companies whose profits went up 30%. So it's a market-driven health insurance company that makes bigger profits for them, and it includes more. I am for including more. That's very important. I give Brother Barack a hand. Yes, but don't fool the people. Don't fool the people. Tell them the truth. You see, you made a deal with big pharmaceutical companies and big insurance companies and health professionals so that their profits will go up, and they did go up. And now we are dealing with some of the blowback, with the premiums and so forth and so on, you see. And that's what we learned about Brother Bernie Sanders. Bernie was honest about it. He said, health care is a right, it's not a privilege. That's what Martin Luther King said. That's what Malcolm X said. And it goes all the way back to A. Philip Garvey and so forth and so on. You see what I mean? So in that sense, I do applaud. What else did Brother Barack do?
Okay, I'm going to come back to you on that because we have only 15 minutes
okay,
left.
Sure.
And you've had 8 years to think about this. And if you're pausing that long, I'll give you another year. I'll come back to you.
I appreciate it. I appreciate your patience. And I appreciate your fairness. You're very kind to me. I appreciate it.
So, Brother West, you did a rap single. Any more in your future?
Oh, I've done 3 albums. Now.
3 albums?
Oh, yeah.
Where was I? Okay, I missed this.
Oh, we were number 38 on the Rhythm and Blues Billboard now. Oh,
okay.
Yeah. Oh, no, I was blessed to be the only brother who Prince was willing to go in the studio and allow us to use his music as sample music. You know, Prince will never allow his music to be used in hip-hop. Ever.
Mm.
But he allowed us to do it, and I'll never forget. We had Talib Kweli, we had KRS-One, we had Rod Digger. It was the last thing that one of the great geniuses in history of rhythm and blues, his name is Gerald LaVert, did.
Yeah.
Gerald LaVert went in the studio with us. Lenny Williams went in the studio with us from Tower of Power. What we tried to do is get a transgenerational coming together because black music is the highest level of black expression of genius, courage, creativity, and compassion. And when our music is thin, our souls are thin. There's no accident that among the younger generation, they don't have groups that sing together in tune like the Dramatics and the Delphonics and the Miracles and the Temptations and the Emotions and the Jones Girls. They only got singles now, you see. And why is that? Well, it's easier not only to control, but it's a me orientation rather than a we consciousness, you see. And so music for me is one of the privileged sites in black culture. That's why in every speech I ever give, I will always accent the Sarah Vaughns who sang in tune. You got a lot of young folk making $1 million, can't sing in tune these days. Because it's not about hitting the note right. It's about selling the records. You see. Or Curtis Mayfield never won a Grammy. Millie Vanilli won two. I don't give a damn. Curtis Mayfield was coming from the depths of his soul and he was a genius. He may have dropped out of junior high, but Juilliard went through him in terms of his mastery of his craft. That's what we need in younger generation. You got Kendrick Lamar, you got a number of others, Anthony Hamilton and others who are part of this tradition. But what I was trying to do on my 3 album.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for correcting me, no, sir.
And I'm not saying that to promote it, even though they do sound good now. But it was just to show, look, musicians are the vanguard of the species. Mm. Not just black people. That's how the first thing you do to objectify your grief, the funeral of your mother or grandmother, you see. It's to transform that moan and that groan into a sound and the silence between those notes so that your soul can keep going on. And you, without that, you can't even think critically. You can't even respect yourself. You can't even determine yourself. You can't even defend yourself. And historically, for black people, we had no rights. We had no land, no territory. Our bodies could be violated, women raped and so forth. All we had was our voices. That's why our anthem is Lift Every Voice. And once our voices become echoes rather than genuine voices. You see, that's the difference between a Luther Vandross. He's an original. Mm. And so many of the young folk today who just imitating each other in order to be successful, in order to make that big money to get that next contract. No, this music ain't about just money making and being an imitation and a copy and a semblance and a simulacra. To be an original like Phyllis Hyman was. To be an original like Nina Simone was. You got to be willing to wrestle and struggle with something inside of you and the world and then engage in a self-emptying. Give it back to the world. Spread it to the world. Touch other souls, touch other bodies, because that's how you became the Nina Simone. That's how you became Phyllis Hyman. That's how you became the Hutchinson Sisters of the Emotions. Mm-hmm. And then when you listen to those voices, David Ruffin's sweetness and gentleness and tenderness from Vicious, Why Not Mississippi, head singer of the Temptations. Here come another genius, Eddie Kendrick, singing falsetto from Birmingham. What goes on with those Negroes? They understand that there's struggle in a voice that is tender. See, we got Try a Little Tenderness. That's my generation. That's Otis Redding. Say My Name, Say My Name, Say My Name. Ooh. That's a decline. That's a shift. So you get folk can't even be tender to each other no more. Even Babyface got a tenderoni. Tenderness is revolutionary for people who've been taught that their bodies are abominations.
Thank you.
You see what I'm saying?
I do.
I wish I could sing a song right now, but
you can.
No, I'm
saying. You can, sir.
I'm just kidding.
We would love it.
No. All those geniuses we've had in our tradition, sure, we can just turn on a little Nat King Cole, turn on a little Johnny Hartman, end with Donnie Hathaway, you know. Lord have mercy. They're the ones who set the standards. And what are the standards? Radical love in freedom and radical freedom in love. Mm. That's Donnie Hathaway from St. Louis. You see, he's free enough because he's trained by a brother named Scott, who also trained Angela Wimbush and some other St. Louis folk. And they master their craft, but they love what they're doing. They love beauty. They love truth. They love the music, and they love the people they're singing to. Mm-hmm. And they love themselves enough and respect themselves enough to hit the notes right and play the notes right and be creative based on the best of the tradition. Because mm-hmm. they know there's some other folk in the back mm-hmm. of that tradition mm-hmm. who's keeping track of them. Mm-hmm. Close track. Ma Rainey's keeping track. Donna, you hitting that note right, honey? Mm-hmm. She's speaking from the grave. Betty, speaking from the grave, you see. Are you getting it right? Nat. King Nat. I'm singing it right? Well, not exactly like you. You're from Alabama and I'm from New York, but I'm inspired by you, Nat. Here's Luther, Mark Miller.
Yeah.
Yes. That is what has kept black people going. That's what sustained us. Even the black lawyer can't make it without the black music. But nowadays it's going to be truth telling, witness bearing. And like Charlie Parker, who blew his horn so intensely that he was willing to die. That's a calling.
Yeah.
That's a calling.
So it sounds to me, I mean, what I hear when you talk about this is the idea that we are all, we're all artists. Whether
we
recognize it or not.
Absolutely.
You said you're a Christian. For me, there are others in the audience who may not share our
sure.
spiritual background.
Sure.
But the idea that we're created by a creator
absolutely.
Who says that we're in his image. And so we are to create, and for some, music. But it sounds to me like everything you've said about the tradition and being authentic and tying in to the pain and the joy and expressing it out in powerful and courageous ways applies to
excellent.
Whatever that calling is. Whatever your art is, whatever your artistry is, whether it's speaking, lawyering, teaching,
absolutely.
Leading, organizing. Yeah?
That's eloquence. Cicero defined eloquence as wisdom speaking. And you have just been so powerfully eloquent. That's wisdom speaking right there. Remember at the very end of Shakespeare's career in The Tempest, and he's retiring at 47 years old, one of the greatest bards ever in any language. And he tells the audience, it's one of the few times Shakespeare speaks in his own language, he tells the audience, he says, all of my words are nothing but artifice if you view them simply as a work of art. Mm. The end is to make your life a work of art. Mm. So that you become an artist in your living, in your loving, in your laughing, in your serving, in your failures and in your successes. And if I haven't done that, then it's empty. My own tradition, it would be, it's sounding brass and tinkling cymbal.
Mm. Mm.
It's foliage, but no fruit. It appears beautiful, but it's not producing nothing on the ground. Shakespeare wanted us to live artistic lives. It wasn't just a matter of showing how smart and clever he was, but the magnificent wordplay that he engaged in, you see. And in so many ways, that represents the best of any struggle for human freedom. You see the same thing in Sondheim, in Into the Woods, where he talks about dreams come true but not free.
Yeah.
That's a powerful theme
yeah.
for America right now.
Yeah.
And that's in the second part of Into the Woods, when Cinderella does get the prince and find out the brother ain't worth that much. She's been dreaming about this cat all this time. And then she gets the prince and says, is that all there is? Dreams come true, but not free. There's a cost to pay.
Yeah.
There's a cost to pay. That's a profound insight of the great Sondheim or the Shakespeare or the Donny Hathaway, any of the great artists that we can invoke. Very much so. In many ways, the great lawyers are artists.
Mm-hmm.
They're dramatists
mm-hmm.
in the legal system, trying to use the various skills and technical insights that they have in order to generate not just vision, but the beautiful fruit of more justice and more fair treatment and so forth and so on.
Well, sir, it has felt a little bit like church here today. I don't know about you guys. Did it feel like church?
Yeah.
It felt like church, which means you probably weren't tweeting, but I swear I've been writing notes of all the tweetable things Dr. West said. So, we want to be on time, and I think we have 2 minutes. And so I would ask this of you as we walk out. You know, some of us.
But should we open it up to questions?
Yeah, they were going to pass us questions. Does anybody have a question that I didn't get on a sheet?
You're tuned to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. This is Urban Connections. I'm your host, Donald Wolf. In studio, Barry Jackson and Ebony Johnson are on site at UMKC. We are broadcasting live from UMKC's law school, Dr. Cornell West.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, so as I go through these questions, let me ask you this, if you can answer this for us. You know, I think part of what we have to do is we have to take back the narrative that people have of us as people of color or any of the other underrepresented groups or marginalized groups. Mm-hmm. And you were most recently at Charlottesville. And, of course, everybody on my team wants to know, what did that feel like? So you have to answer that. But also, as we go forth, I think a lot of us in the room are the kind of people who want a 1-2-3. We want an action step. Like, what can I do when I walk out of here? As I sift through these questions, I'd love it if you can answer that question of, how do we tackle the narrative? How do we rewrite the narrative? How do we reframe the discussion? How do we engage in the work? Right? Knowing that we all have diverse experiences, diverse talents, diverse spheres of influence, and so the work is not going to look the same.
I want to remind you that we are in the midst of our pledge drive for the fall 2017. We need your support to continue bringing you programming like this live broadcast of Dr. Cornell West speaking at UMKC. I want to ask you now to take some action. Go to your phones and give us a call at 888-931-0901. That's 888-931-0901. Thanks, Rosie, for your sustaining donation, and Dustin, also for your generous support. Do like them, folks. Give us a call at 888-931-0901. Returning you now to UMKC School of Law, Dr. Cornell West speaking.
Not just courage, because a Nazi soldier can be courageous and still be a gangster. Looks fear in the face and still want to kill somebody and willing to die. But courage tied to a grand cause, freedom, democracy, something broader that includes all of us. You see, that's what one can do. And then be connected to whatever kinds of organizations are available here in Kansas City and so forth. Because we need voices raised. We need people in the street. We need people in the courts, people in laboratories. We have to have people who straighten their backs up, raise their voices, and are involved in various kinds of actions.
Yes.
And we are experiencing, especially among the younger generation. I mean, one of the wonderful things about not just Charlottesville, but Ferguson, Baltimore, Oakland, Chicago, a number of places I've been blessed to go, is that the younger generation's on fire in a way that the older generation is running out of gas.
Hmm.
If American citizens under 30 could vote, Bernie Sanders would be in the White House right now. A very different perspective about how you go about changing the world, you see. Very different. So it's a beautiful thing to witness. And it is multiracial. You got vanilla brothers and sisters willing to fight and die. The sister who died in Charlottesville, Sister Heather, she was standing right next to me. She had the flag, the IWW flag. She was a white sister, 32 years old. And she's willing to die. She's like Ann Braden. She's like Miles Horton. She's like John Brown. There's a whole tradition of white brothers and sisters willing to fight against white supremacy. Now, the problem is they got a lot of cousins. Who usually outnumber them. But you don't downplay their particular role, and they're there. Rabbi Joshua Heschel and Michael Lerner and Rabbi Waskow and others, they're there. They're doing very important things, you see. And what we see in these gatherings is a coming together. Mm-hmm. It's a coming together. I say the same thing about Standing Rock with our indigenous brothers and sisters. I say the same thing about the Women's March, not just the Women's March in January. That was very much a coalition, but dominated by neoliberals, but the one in March the 8th, where you had poor women, you had working women, you had homophobia and transphobia at the center of feminism. Boss feminism, corporate feminism, top-down feminism is not enough. You got to talk about the sisters of all colors who are on the ground catching hell.
Yeah.
Not just the professional ones. What's the sister talking about leaning in? What's her name? Steinberg?
Cheryl Steinberg.
Yeah, Sister Cheryl leaning in. I said, oh, no, these sisters getting crushed. You leaning, they getting crushed. Now, I'm for you leaning in because I'm against violation of women's rights. I don't care who they are, elite, non-elite, working. But don't act as if the elite model is the sole model for women across the board. Don't act as if white feminism is the only model for brown and black and red women and so forth and so on. You can have a dialogue. You can have an engagement. We learn from each other in that way. But one of the reasons why I'm blessed to spend time in these contexts is because I love to learn and listen from young folk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that I'm younger than I really am. And I'm always eager to look at the world in a very different way because, I mean, there's so many things about the contemporary world I just don't understand.
Mm.
You know, people crazy about, what's that show? Game of Thrones or Throne of Games or something like that?
Oh, yeah, Game of Thrones.
You got people so evangelical about that show. I watched that thing for 45 minutes. I said, oh, Lord, life is too short. What am I missing something? What is going on? Oh, and I can see I'm so far behind. I'm on a different vibe. That's what it is to be old school. And I have to shatter that. I got to learn to look at the world through different lenses. And looking at the world through different lenses is easy when you're in the heat of battle with the young folk, you see. And because there were not too many old school folk, you know, at those gatherings.
Yeah.
We need more old school folk. The new school folk need to know there's some old school folk who love them very much.
Right.
Who are
right.
willing to be with them and put their body on the line very, very much.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
One of the things you talked about earlier was you talked about the black middle class and upper class and the disconnect.
Yeah. Yes.
I won't try to remove myself from the group, but...
Well, both of us.
Yeah.
In terms of...
Yeah, but what I hear you saying is... We've removed ourselves and been disconnected. And not too long ago, I heard someone say that during the times where communities were segregated, you had black people of different occupations, different socioeconomic status, all living together. It was a community. And so there was more of that, for lack of a better phrase, you know, the African proverb of it takes a village to raise a child. Everybody was more involved with one another. And now there is some separation. And this person that I was listening to made the argument that integration is part of what has happened. That integration, while good in terms of, you know, the grand collectivist national picture, has made it harder for black children growing up to actually see issues that are collectively affecting the black community. And I found that to be a very curious thing that I've been thinking about ever since. And someone in the audience actually has this question.
Mm-hmm.
Says, what has integration done to black people? Are we too integrated, suffering a loss of our individual pride as a group of black people? And given everything you've said about spirituality and the collective history and our traditions, I'd like you to speak to that question. It came from Ebony Johnson.
Mm-hmm. Oh, appreciate that, Sister Ebony. Absolutely. You remember Martin King raised that question to Harry Belafonte 3 days before he was shot. Are we integrated into a burning house? And if so, we have to become fire women, fire men to put the fire out. You see? And it had to do with what will be some of the consequences and effects of integration, especially those who have the opportunity to integrate. Most of our precious and priceless black poor and working class brothers and sisters are hardly integrated at all. See, Jim Crow Senior was legalized terrorism. We live now in Jim Crow Junior. It's de facto. Where we live, what schools we attend, right across the board, churches, mosques, synagogues, social life, and so forth. You see, for the black middle classes, the integration is able to become much more expansive with unprecedented results. And that's, you know, that's fine. They make their choices and so forth and deserve it. Because people have a right to choose. You know, you're not, you can't coerce people to do things. Mm-hmm. They got a right to choose no matter what. But whatever choices they make, they have to be responsible. They got to be accountable, you see. But the other factor that we have to include here is the shift of black working and poor neighborhoods from ghettos to hoods. See, a ghetto is still a neighborhood. So when Donny Hathaway and Leroy Hutson sing about the ghetto, they sing about love, sympathy, empathy, people keeping track of other people's kids. The deacons and the pastors were still concerned about what was happening with the kids rather than just the building fund. See, the pastor wasn't the CEO then. He was a real pastor. You know what I mean? The choirs were real choirs, not praise teams. I mean, we got a shift that took place. Hoods, guns, drugs, massive unemployment, decrepit schools, indecent housing. And so it became difficult for anybody to stay there who could get out because you didn't want to get killed. Hmm. That makes all the sense in the world. Everybody got one life to live on this side of the Jordan. If you got to deal with drugs every day with the guns in it, and of course the drugs are what? That's the underside of predatory capitalism. It's global. Billions and billions and billions of dollars, and those who are behind it never, ever, for the most part, go to jail. Those who go to jail are the folk who are selling on the corner and so forth. And that's a transformation. See, when I grew up in Glen Elder in Sacramento, you know, it was a ghetto, but we didn't think of it as a ghetto because we were having a good time. It was a neighborhood. Mm-hmm. We were broke as the Ten Commandments financially, but we had a good time. We didn't have bullets every day. We didn't have drugs. And we hardly knew we were poor. Now, we had a number of black folk drinking too much Boone Farm on the corner every day. Because the addictive big personalities were still there. The despair was still there. But it hadn't taken the form of this militarized state, guns and so forth. So that what happens is the integration. Middle classes can get away from that, and our precious poor folk is just caught unprotected. Unprotected, you see. And, you know, you think of Tupac, they're called Tupac what? The rose that got through the concrete. Yeah. We got some roses to get through the concrete, but a lot of our folk, you know, they don't make it. Mm-hmm. Early deaths, the shooting been going on and on and on and on, you see.
So this leads to this question from Robert Bivona.
Robert Bivona.
He asks, public policies that would create a far more just, democratic, and prosperous society exist. Do you agree it is time to demand in detail what we want with a comprehensive social reform program? And he refers to a website, but I can't read that. So comprehensive social reform program,
absolutely.
Where we put in detail what we want. What do you think about that?
Very much so. I mean, we already have an example of that in the platform of the Movement for Black Lives. I don't know how many people have read that. It deserves serious reading. It's 60 pages. Mm-hmm. It lays out comprehensive fundamental change. And you may not agree with every point. Nobody's going to agree with every point. They have thought it out. 50 organizations went into the making of that. And that's very important because once you get it out, just like, you know, our writings or Brother Coach's writings, once you get it out there, then it's time for Socratic energy.
Yeah.
It's time for critique. It's time for dialogue and so forth. But at least they've got that platform out there. And it comes from the younger generation. And they have thought very hard and wide and deep. And it's very important not to confuse the hashtag Black Lives Matters with the Movement for Black Lives. They're not the same thing. The latter consists of a whole host of organizations. They just had a strategic meeting down in Jackson, Mississippi, week before last. It's a multi-organizational effort. And those kind of platforms make a difference. Mm-hmm. They make a very important difference. Mm-hmm. I would also read the annual report of the Urban League.
Okay.
Anybody recall the name of that Black America report or something like that? It's one of the best empirically based analysis that we have of where we are as a people. They may not agree with the Urban League's analysis. They're not radical enough for me, but I just love the moderate brothers and sisters because they're getting that information out there. You see, and it's comprehensive. Very important. Very important indeed.
Do you follow Dr. John Powell at the Haas Institute for Belonging out of UC Berkeley?
I don't follow him closely.
Yeah.
I just...
Some good work coming out of there, too.
Absolutely. No, that's another one.
Yeah, very much about belonging, community, and addressing...
Absolutely.
All the intersectional issues we've talked about today. So you talked about, you put the work out there, you put the ideas out there, but Socratic, you will receive some criticism. And we've talked today about criticism of people in the work that, you know, we respect and we love, but maybe they didn't do enough. So this question ties into critique and the ability to dialogue. Joseph Sakazar asks, are you concerned about college campuses limiting speeches by controversial conservative figures? So embedded in this question, obviously, is a premise that colleges are limiting speeches by controversial conservative figures. But this is a topic that I think we've been talking about now for maybe 2 years, where people feel like college campuses have gone a little bit crazy with all the restrictions, and there's been criticism about safe spaces and more. Can you speak to that question about dialogue and limiting speech on college campuses and whether you're concerned?
Yes. Well, I've been blessed to work for over 10 years with my dear right-wing brother, Robbie George. We've taught courses together at Princeton. We travel all around the country. And we've called for a robust conversation across ideological and political lines that's mediated with respect. Yeah. And I'm deeply committed to that. I would add something to this question, though. When you say controversial right-wing figures, I would say controversial high-quality right-wing figures. You see, Milo and Richard Spencer and these folk, you see, they don't deserve a space in a context where people have been studying and wrestling with issues for a long time. In the same way that, you know, in the 1970s, you're not going to bring in Rudy Ray Moore to give an analysis of where we are in Black America. He doesn't deserve that. He's a different kind of figure. You bring in John Hope Franklin. You bring in James Baldwin. When you're talking about quality, you only have so many slots in a university during the year. There are some high-quality right-wing folk who deserve attention. But it's not the cliche-ridden, shibboleth-ridden folk who are out there making money who are just trying to expand their market and for the most part, devalue and debase the gays, the lesbians, the trans, the black folk, the Jews, the Arabs, and so forth. So when we talk about dialogue, and we include this in our statement with Brother Robbie George, because Robbie George is a high-quality conservative brother. By high-quality, I mean he's got arguments. He's read some things. And as Nietzsche used to say, you're only as strong as your critics anyway. The critics make you stronger, which means he's going to have to read some progressive stuff to generate his conservative response. Left-wing brother like myself, I've got to read conservative stuff to show them how they're usually wrong. It's true. But for example, Brother Clarence Thomas. Brother Clarence Thomas is right-wing to the core. He deserves to speak on campus. He's just wrong most of the time. He deserves to speak. But some of these folk who they trotting out, oh, Lord, have mercy. It's pathetic.
All right. It's so pathetic. I have to push back on you, sir.
Sure.
Just a little bit.
Absolutely. I deserve it. I'm sure.
So two things embedded in what you said.
Mm-hmm.
You said, you know, high-quality folks, which of course means that somebody has to decide who's quality.
Absolutely.
Right?
That's right.
And that is an opinion. And of course, we live in this country where, you know, as a lawyer, I get so irritated at how much we misunderstand the First Amendment. But we have a feeling that we should be able to have a free exchange of ideas. So there's that. Who gets to decide what's quality and what's not, first? But then second, if we limit speech in that way, the argument that people have made on the other side is that we're not training college students to engage, to be the ones to go through and sift the wheat from the chaff and say, you're not very good and you are, or to be able to have controversial figures come on campus and to be able to hear them and either respond or not respond, but not to shut down the speech, you know. And those are two I guess, compound question. I apologize.
No, that's fair. That's fair, though. That is fair, though. But look at it this way. Let's say in the natural sciences.
Okay.
That somebody could just say, oh, I've got a subtle version of creationism that I want to gift in the physics department. It's not going to fly. It's just not going to fly. Somebody else say, I can show in the most imaginative way that the earth is really flat. No, I think you're both going back home, watch TV, and work it out on your own. That is, so you have to have some limits in any discussion. If the ignorance is so overwhelming, the most subtle, ignorant-based argument is still going to be something you won't have time for. You see what I mean? So, that, for example, the difference between a Clarence Thomas and a Richard Spencer. We can make a judgment about that. We can make a judgment about that. So that when Thomas shows up, get your intellectual equipment ready. Go at that brother. He's got some equipment, too. You see, with Spencer, he's just going to bring in his little neo-Nazi group. He's going to lay out his cliches. Next thing you know, it's going to be in the New York Times, and he gets more visibility than ever. And more money, and so forth and so on. So that's the kind of distinction I'm making, you see. The difference between, you know, Noam Chomsky and some left-wing person on the corner who's talking about how capitalism was a conspiracy going back to the Garden of Eden. You say, okay, that's interesting, very creative. We ain't got time for that in this context. It is Missouri, the serious law school. Y'all got serious law school here. Well, you had to make some judgments. That's all I'm saying. You got to make some judgments.
Well, sir, you've been so generous. You've given us an extra 20 minutes for people to ask you additional questions, but we really do need to wrap it up. And so if you didn't get your question answered, we'll bring him back again maybe. We'll find a way to get your questions answered. So I'm going to end with this question, if you could. Mm-hmm. What was it like to record Freedom with William Bootsy Collins, and what made it important for you to record that particular song? So you're going to close us out here on a high note, talking about something you love, music.
Yeah, we're talking about Bootsy Collins from Cincinnati, Ohio, brother of Catfish. As a teenager, he was selected by James Brown from the Pacers to be part of the JBs. Who helped write Soul Power, Talking Loud and Saying Nothing, Super Bad, Part 1 and Part 2. He only stayed 11 months, but you would have thought that he stayed for years. Because Bootsy is a genius. He's my dear brother. I've worked with him for many, many years. We've gone to churches around the country. And he's a funk master. And that's very important, because I think intellectuals should be funk masters. Because a funk master is somebody who's highly suspicious of deodorized discourses that hide and conceal the suffering.
Did you say deodorized discourses?
Sanitized, sterilized, deodorized discourses that stay on the surface, that don't want to get down in the funk where the reality is. Because each and every one of us, we emerge in the funk of our mama's womb. And it's stinky down there. And it's bloody down there. But that's where the love is, too. And that's where black people, as funk masters, at our best, we keep it real in the sense of making sure that the love, the pain, the joy, and the sorrow are so interwoven in such a way that when you emerge from that womb, emerge from the context, You like Bootsy, you are equipped. He just got his guitar as his equipment. A lawyer got legal skills, and a writer has his or her pen. Love you, Bootsy. Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Was this marvelous?
Oh, indeed. Thank you all very much. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
This was a pleasure. You were a blessing for me. You were so wonderful, so fair, everything. Yes, my brother. Yeah, how we doing?
Right there. Here's the script. That's the recording.
I'm listening to 90.1. Oh, this is where we're doing. Okay, you tell me, my brother.
Okay.
Hey, this is Brother Cornell West, and you are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI. I'm talking about that magnificent station in Kansas City, Community Radio.
Could I get you to do one more? Okay, got it.
Hey, this is... Hey, this is Brother Cornell West, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, which is in Kansas City. It is a community radio.
Doctor, don't forget Chuck Berry, the blowback he got all his life.
Oh, I know. You
the
ain't
real
lying.
Studio.
And the Beast Boy doing it.
90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. This is Urban Connections. I'm your host, Donna Morrow Wolf. Our co-host, Ebony Johnson, and Barry Jackson, our very own Fusion Funkmeister. And I know that was Barry's question that was asked at the end of Dr. Cornell West. You've heard him speaking live at UMKC's School of Law, and we had the privilege to broadcast that live here for you today on Urban Connections, starting at 3:30 on Every Woman. Sharon, you want to say something? And yet another great collaborative effort here at KKFI.
I would like to just ask people to call in at 888-931-0901 and pledge your dollars to KKFI programming, which is so magnificent and so flexible that we are able to do something as special as this at this time. That's 888-931-0901.
Yes.
Please make your phone call now.
I second that. And we're going to take you out this afternoon with Freedom featuring Dr. Cornell West with Bootsy Collins, that recording that he was speaking about just a few moments ago. Please stay tuned after that for Guess Who's Coming to Kansas City with MC Richardson.
Yeah. One crime.